This is Voices of Our World. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. President Theodore Roosevelt said, "To announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by the president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public." That's not what we've got right now. When the Army Corps of Engineers' top procurement official, Bunateen Greenhouse, objected to continuing to hand no-bid long-term contracts to Halliburton without annual review, she lost her job. When Army General Eric Shinseki warned Congress that the Bush administration grossly underestimated the manpower needed to control Iraq, well, that's the last public comment anyone heard from him. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and counterterrorism advisor Richard Clark spoke out well before any of us ever heard the Downing Street memo, saying the administration was fixed on trumping up justification for their war agenda. And they swiftly joined the unemployed. Four weapons of mass destruction investigators in succession, Scott Ritter, Dr. David Kay, Charles Dulfer, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohammed El-Baradei, all had their reputations smeared when they agreed there were no WMD. And of course, when former Ambassador Joe Wilson reported that Iraq had not tried to purchase uranium from Niger, somebody in the inner sanctum thought it might be a kick to expose the identity of his covert CIA agent wife. On the other hand, despite Bunateen's ethics, Vice President Dick Cheney's Halliburton stock options rose 3,281% since the start of the war. The affable former Undersecretary for Arms Control, John Bolton, got the top U.S. post at the United Nations, even after stating that it'd be just fine if the top 10 floors blew up. The CIA's George, failed to connect the dots, Tenet, and J. Paul, $8 million missing from the Iraqi treasury, Bremer, both got the Medal of Freedom. Michael, doing a heck of a job, Brownie, Brown, 3 days after he lost his FEMA job for incompetence, got rehired by FEMA to investigate what went wrong. Now the president wants his personal lawyer, who served as a Texas lottery executive, to be appointed to the Supreme Court. Maybe it's high time we stopped putting the ultra-rich and their scions into office. Maybe we should be sending people to Washington who, like us, are having trouble paying for health care, their kids' college tuition, and gasoline. Let's go back to sending Mr. or Mrs. Smith to Washington by making sure they can afford to run for office. Back to Kathy and Colleen Rowley.
There are good leaders and there are good managers who do listen to people on the bottom. But, you know, unfortunately, what we're seeing right now, I think, is more the opposite. We're seeing this need for control, a lot of it due to the belief that these preconceived conclusions and ideological positions outweigh reality. They outweigh evidence. And again, the best examples come from true science, where somebody actually will find hard scientific evidence, and even that cannot be listened to.
Ms. Watkins was one of the women on the cover with you. Who was the third woman? Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yes, her name was Cynthia Cooper. She was also a very brave individual that, very likewise, she was the auditor at WorldCom. And when she found that the reporting of the profits and stuff was not adding up, she insisted on an audit at WorldCom. And in fact, she did the same thing as Sharon Watkins. She went to Bernie Ebbers. When WorldCom CEO Bernie Ebbers was being prosecuted recently, they called Cynthia Cooper as a potential defense witness. Because when she went to him, of course, she thought, well, he'll understand the need for an audit. And of course, what happened is she kind of got stonewalled on her request for an audit and had to actually insist on one.
Tell us a little bit about your own testimony and your own experience. I know you're probably very tired of this story, but it's a very telling moment in our history.
Yeah, our history has moved so fast in the 4 years that there's been a great amount of distortion. There was an inquiry by the Joint Intelligence Committee of the House and the Senate, and that was the one that Eleanor Hill, the former Pentagon official, was put in charge of the staff. This began about 6 months after 9/11. This was the very first inquiry. If you go back, you remember the Bush administration was fighting tooth and nail to have these facts come out, and they fought any kind of nonpartisan commission. But they had to agree to this Joint Intelligence Committee. I got called to talk to the staffers, and when that happened, it was 9 months after 9/11, and we were still stuck on this blanket defense that nothing could have been done to prevent 9/11. All of the officials, it's like a lot of marketing. If you say it and repeat it often enough, people will come to believe it. And they were saying it all the time. And it was pretty much going down then as historical fact that nothing could have been done to prevent 9/11. Well, my letter, the impact of my 12 pages there, putting all of these little facts that I knew together, and the one distortion that has been really serious now in 4 years is that I was not the investigator of this Moussaoui case. I merely had a very peripheral role. That's in my 12 pages, but it's gotten lost. I had a peripheral role as the legal person in the office, giving advice to these agents. And of course, I knew that we could not merely say that this was hindsight. In many cases, if you're fighting liability, it's a very common and actually legitimate defense to say, well, yes, that you appreciate it now after these facts have occurred, but that's hindsight. And of course, that works fine if you don't have anyone appreciating. But the one fact that was missing is that, yes, there were people who had appreciated the danger before 9/11. And that was, of course, being glossed over and ignored because it did not fit with this blanket defense that nothing could have been done to prevent 9/11. So my letter, I think, in a way, it gave rise to another inquiry. The Inspector General of the Department of Justice began a lengthy investigation that went up for over 2 years. As a result, my letter spurred that inquiry. And both the Joint Intelligence Committee's report and the Inspector General's report were used then as the basis of some of the things that are said in the 9/11 Commission.
And take us back to August of 2001, when certain of your coworkers and yourself in the Minneapolis office are alerting D.C. What was the response? What did you get?
Well, the agents, there were three agents, and they were, you know, literally pulling their hair out, arguing with headquarters. And again, this goes to my point about, you know, this was not a failure of appreciation. One particular agent, he was the acting supervisor, was actually on the phone with headquarters trying again to get authority to go for a further search, said, this is a kind of a guy who could fly into the World Trade Center. And the response from headquarters was, that isn't going to happen. That ain't going to happen. And that's one of the biggest points now. This wasn't obviously only due to failure to appreciate in hindsight. There were people who understood the threat. Right now, I don't know exactly. Of course, I shouldn't be talking about this because I certainly haven't read his book. But the former FBI director, Louis Freeh, is putting out his book.
I heard.
And apparently, he is going to back to that old blanket defense. I heard this just briefly on 60 Minutes. You know, he used the analogy that intelligence is like a fire hose, and you can't get a drink from a fire hose because it's, you know, running too hard. And his point is that it was impossible to prevent 9/11. But obviously, I'll have to read his book because I would not agree with that premise at all.
Hey, if I was the president and somebody handed me a brief that said Osama bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States, I would have taken that seriously.
There was lots more than that. You know,
sure.
When I wrote the letter, of course, I only knew one tiny little, this little tiny area. And what has come out now in the meantime from the 9/11 Commission and even from other things, the Able Danger Unit that apparently even had two or three of the hijackers' names had surfaced in this intelligence unit a year before 9/11. That piece has just come out. Even the 9/11 Commission ignored it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots, you know, the FAA, this is another huge piece that people ignore a lot. The FAA had 50-some warnings in a year or two preceding 9/11. And all they would have had to do, of course, Louis Freeh carefully ignored this when he gave his defense, but all they would have had to do is order the doors, the cockpit doors, to be bolted shut. They did that immediately after 9/11, and it's worked very well because you can't use a rudimentary tool like a bolt cutter to get into a cockpit door now. So that little measure, and people say, well, how would you would never have known that. Yes, you would have. The doors on Israeli airlines were bolted for years before this. So these are things that are not exactly hindsight. They are, of course, if people want to come up with their defense and their excuses for not having thought more and have acted in more aggressive ways.
Yeah. Actually, a good year ago, we spoke to Sibel Edmonds, another name I'm pretty sure you're familiar with. I read somewhere that you wanted since the time you were about 11 years old, wanted to be in the FBI. Can you tell me what that was about for you?
Well, I suppose at 11, it was not much more than the fascination with this real cool television show. Like kids in today's world, back then, Man from U.N.C.L.E. was a television show that was very popular. It was these two kind of spy guys who were the heroes, and I wrote to our newspaper and asked, when I grow up, I want to join U.N.C.L.E. Then they wrote back and said, well, U.N.C.L.E. is a fictional entity, but in the United States, there's something similar called the FBI. And so I wrote to the FBI and was sent their 99 facts about the FBI, a lot of information. I was all excited. I remember reading to maybe question 60-some, and all of these responses about the FBI were so intriguing to a young kid. Until you get to 60-some, and then it was, why can't women become FBI agents? It was actually phrased in the negative. And J. Edgar Hoover, of course, I didn't know this at the time, was very seriously prejudiced against women and had this rule up until he died that women could not become FBI agents. And there was this convoluted explanation about the job being difficult and challenging and you needed to dominate the situation and all this stuff. It never explained exactly why women couldn't do it. I remember when I was 11, I read this question and answer and said to myself, well, that's about the stupidest thing I've ever read. That'll have to change by the time I grow up. And by the time I had grown up and gone through law school, the FBI was, in fact, hiring women.
Thank you again so much, Colleen Rowley, running for the United States Congress in Minnesota. I wish you the very best of luck and continue to always try.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Colleen.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye.
Whether in business or government, on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is integrity? Email us. Go to our website, www.voicesofourworld.org. Just click on Contact Us or call us at 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. Well, that's all for this week, and thanks for listening. Colleen Rowley is just one of the voices of our world. I'm your host, Eileen Bott. You heard music today by Ben Sharoni. Our website is www.voicesofourworld.org. You can listen, learn more about today's guests and topics, and answer our weekly question. Check it out, www.voicesofourworld.org. To learn more about Mary Knoll or try Mary Knoll Magazine in English or Spanish, call 877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 877-MARYKNOLL. And please join us next time for more Voices of Our World.